podcast for Tuesday, January 20th. I'm your host, John Lord. With me today to talk some NBA hoops is the associate editor at Ball Don't Lie, Yahoo's NBA blog, Dan Devine. All right, Dan, why don't you go ahead and tell everyone how at the beginning of the season you predicted an Atlanta Hawks Golden State Warriors NBA Finals?
Yeah, I mean, it's sure. It's easy to look back now and say, that was an amazing call by me. But I really just felt it. You know, I thought there was these were two teams on the rise, and they would be, you know, after 40 some odd games, they would just be head and shoulders above everybody else, which is a lie. That is not accurate. That is not what I predicted. It's to be honest with you, I mean, I know they exist somewhere. I know that there's a Yahoo Sports NBA predictions infographic somewhere that's got my smiling face and some things on it. I don't really quite remember what I picked because the week and a half or so before the season is like a crazy preview blur. So I'm pretty sure I had Chicago coming out of the East, and I think I took San Antonio to repeat. So neither of those look excellent right now. I think there's still defensible picks if you expect that, you know, eventually Rose and Noah are going to get back to being who, you know, something more like who they are, and that San Antonio, after they get, you know, they've got Kawhi Leonard back, they'll sort of get on a run, could be a dangerous team in the West. But, you're right. Atlanta and Golden State, definitely not, I think, what most people picked to be, head and shoulders above the rest of their conferences.
The Hawks, the run they're on right now is truly astounding. And I don't know if there are many folks outside of NBA fandom circles who understand just how good Atlanta is playing. They've won 13 in a row. They're 34-8. They have the best record in the Eastern Conference, the second best record in all of basketball. And as you wrote on Ball Don't Lie, I think sometime maybe late last week, maybe over the weekend, they don't really have a marquee all-star player. They run, you know, a 10-man rotation. And you could argue, and I think you did argue in your article, that they have four all-stars, but they don't have that household name type player that people who don't follow the NBA on a daily basis would really know.
That's absolutely right. And I should give credit where it's due. For the people that I saw that made, you know, sort of the best cases for the Hawks getting multiple all-stars and possibly as many as four, given their records, were Zach Harper at CBSSports.com and Steve Ashburn at NBA.com, who wrote a couple of great pieces, that are linked to in the 10-man rotation post I put together. I wrote sort of at length about the Hawks. Earlier on in their streak, you know, when it was kind of, because I had been sort of away from the league for a little bit when I came back, but that was one of the main surprises for me, was that the Hawks had gone on this major run, and sort of tried to look at what they do and how they're doing it, and balance really is a huge key. You know, you talk about a team that, you know, with, you know, sort of the template for all this stuff is, to me, is always Carmelo Anthony with the Nuggets and now with the Knicks. There was always that question of, late in the game, you know, final possession, you're going to go to your star, right? But when everybody knows you're going to go to your star, even if he's excellent at scoring the ball, everyone knows how to defend you. So maybe wouldn't it be a better argument, at least, you know, maybe for the regular season, if not the playoffs, to be able to sort of divide that scoring load through the system as opposed to, you know, going through one particular guy. We saw it really be really successful with San Antonio last year with their sort of many hands make light work approach. And, that did wind up leading to a title. And this year, the Hawks are doing something very similar where, you know, Al Horford, you know, having him healthy has been a huge, huge difference. Missed chunks of the last two seasons with torn pectoral muscles. Now, you know, back fully healthy, you know, impacting the game on both ends, not in a particularly flashy way, but just, you know, an excellent offensive player who does the dirty work and can also, you know, sort of explode for big plays when they're needed. Kyle Korver has been just an absolute, you know, marksman for them, you know, flirting with a 50-50-90 mark, you know, making better than half his shots, better than half his three-pointers, and 90% of his free throws, which no one's ever done in NBA history. And just the way he pulls defenses toward him opens up all sorts of opportunities for the other guys in the team. And then, you know, Paul Millsap is a guy, power forward, who's been, you know, a very good player for a while now, but, you know, always sort of flew under the radar in Utah, didn't get a big contract to come to Atlanta and join the Hawks, but has been perfect for them in terms of what they like to do with spreading the floor, playing four out and five out offense. And Jeff Teague is, you know, a guy that was a, you know, sort of a high pick out of Wake Forest, a guy that was well regarded at the point, and you know, signed a restricted free agent contract with Milwaukee that Atlanta decided to match and bring him back. And people sort of weren't sure if he was gonna be that, you know, make that leap to be an all-star caliber point guard. And he's really doing that this year. You know, I believe fourth or fifth in the Eastern Conference in player efficiency rating, which isn't a perfect stat, but it's a decent sort of you know, thumbnail sketch of how well a player has been impacting the game, at least offensively. He's been sensational, and that system they run under Mike Budenholzer has really got everybody kind of dangerous on any given night. It's been an awful lot of fun to watch over this last month and a half or so.
Yeah, you know, the connection to the San Antonio Spurs, the parallels there are fascinating to me. You mentioned the coach Budenholzer, and obviously he was in San Antonio for over a decade, and they run a system similar to what San Antonio runs. They're kind of like the Spurs Southeast, and their offense relies so much on, you know, precise ball movement, and it comes down to when you have, you know, NBA defenses that aren't the most disciplined, that extra pass leads to a really open look, and when you have the shooters that can also help space the floor, you're going to get easy shots. And it's funny, watching the Hawks, I really enjoy watching Atlanta because they do seem different than a lot of other NBA teams where, you know, you find that it's a star-driven league, and the stars tend to, you know, like to take a lot of air out of the ball and just dribble the ball, and it's a lot of one-on-one high pick and roll, and the Hawks don't really do that as much. So it's refreshing in a way, and it reminds me a lot of not just the Spurs but also college basketball, and the fact that you have almost like shifts of players that come in and out of the game looks and feels a lot like what, you know, the University of Kentucky is doing this year, where they have, you know, those 10 players that they almost run in like they would different lines of hockey players.
Right. It's kind of neat to see that sort of approach. Like, it's like if you have the college sort of approach, but with legit NBA talent up and down the roster, which, you know, you don't always see in college ball, but yeah, it's been a lot of fun to watch for sure.
And what's, you know, what's interesting is that, so not a lot of people are talking about Atlanta, even though they should. We're talking about them today. But it doesn't seem as if the, you know, outside of the circles that follow the NBA, that the Hawks are still given kind of much of a chance to win the East. And if you look on, you know, gambling sites today, you'll see that they're perhaps one of three or four favorites to come out of the East. You still have teams like the Cavs and the Bulls and the Wizards and the Raptors that are in some places listed ahead of Atlanta. And whether or not that's fair, it certainly seems like there are people who are still not sure if they're ready to buy Atlanta. But when you watch games like last night's Cavs-Bulls game, certainly both of those teams have their flaws as well. So really, the question is, why not Atlanta?
And it's a great question. I mean, it's especially hard to answer when they've won 27 of their last 29 games. I mean, it's you know, they're looking, you know, looking at the NBA's you know, stat tool now, they've been outscoring teams by almost 11 points per 100 possessions since Thanksgiving. That's like an imaginary number. You know, they're blowing teams out like nobody's business. The only team that's even, you know, got anything in the neighborhood of that right now is Golden State, who, as we mentioned earlier, on the other coast is doing exactly the same sorts of things, but they're doing it a few hours later. So there is Stephen Curry there, so at least there's a star to talk about there. But in Atlanta, yeah, I think that really people aren't necessarily believing that. I mean, this is the sort of the flip side of that, you know, question of would you want Carmelo to have the ball in the clutch, or would you want sort of the open guy shooting? I think there is still a lack, a tendency to be uncertain about whether a team that doesn't have a defined go-to guy in those situations is going to be able to replicate its offensive success over the course of a playoff series, a seven-game series, where your opposition has just, they can do nothing but game plan for you and be prepared for your pet sets and your counters and everything, and sort of maybe lock in a little bit better on your motion offense rather than, you know, a team that's, you know, you're playing four games in 7 nights, and then all of a sudden you go into Atlanta and you get your doors blown off. I think that there's still some uncertainty that a lot of these players who haven't really had that level of success or experience in the postseason will be able to, you know, hold to their line what they've produced so far when, you know, the matchups get tighter and the level of competition increases. And I think there's also just a tendency to, you know, when you talk about gambling sites and things like that, you know, the public is much more familiar with a team that has LeBron James and Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving on it, or a team that has Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah and Pau Gasol on it. And to a certain extent, even now, I mean, Washington doesn't have quite that same level of profile, but John Wall is an ascendant star in this league. He was an all-star last year, won the dunk contest. You know, he's got an increasing level of profile there, and has only been, you know, playing sensational ball this year as well. So I think that there's a, you know, when you can sort of point to, you know, oh, that's the team with that guy, or, oh, that guy's a beast, or those two guys, it's going to be awful tough to stop them. With Atlanta, it's more like, those nine guys are pretty tough to stop, and certainly those top four or five. And I think that's it's going to take a longer period of time to maybe capture the public's imagination. Plus, there's also the pretty decent, you know, potentially decent argument here that, you know, I don't know that you can expect Atlanta to continue to play like 900 ball over the course of the next 50 games. Like, I mean, they're about as hot as you can be right now. And sustaining that level of play over the second half without injury, without incident, that's going to be awful tough to do.
The Bulls and the Cavs played a game last night, and it's amazing at how quickly fortunes can change in the NBA. You know, the big story last week and the week before that was that, you know, without LeBron James, the Cavs really struggled to play competent basketball, let alone competitive basketball. And LeBron's come back, and the Cavs have won three in a row, and everything seems hunky-dory with the coach in Cleveland. And contrast that with the Chicago Bulls, who have lost a couple games in a row, have not played their best basketball over the last few weeks, have injuries. You know, Joakim Noah is out, Derrick Rose, you never know. And so there are some pressing concerns there. And it's funny how the narrative shifts. Yesterday, where you have the Cavs that were heading into that game, that they were maybe the team that people were worried about. Now, after they beat the Bulls yesterday, it seems like we're all now worried about Chicago. And Derrick Rose kind of came out after the game and made some comments about how they're not really playing well together as a team and how guys need to give their best effort and communicate. And these are kind of some buzzwords for a team that might be facing a little dysfunction, which is shocking to me because the story out of Chicago was always that you have a group, a very talented group of basketball players that play so well together in part because of their coach. That's what he expects of them. And it just doesn't seem like this is the type of momentum or behavior that we've come to expect with Chicago. And I wonder personally if it's got something to do with that kind of grinded out, grueling style. If this is an indication of the Bulls players are just feeling worn down. I mean, are they going to really go through another slogging, long season of the grind that Coach Tibbs puts them through? I wonder if there's some backlash there. I wonder if what Rose was referring to is something that has to do with the coaching.
I mean, it's difficult to say. I think that, you know, there are actual on-court reasons, you know, in terms of what they have available and what they're playing with that they've struggled over the last couple of weeks, especially on the defensive end. You know, I mean, Joakim Noah hasn't been right basically all season. You know, he had the, you know, off-season surgery that was termed to be, I believe on his knee, that was termed to be like a minor cleanup that then kept him sidelined for like 3 months, which that doesn't have, that's not minor. That's not a cleanup. Something happened. And he hasn't really been operating nearly as in quite the same way that as he has in the recent past, especially last year during the Defensive Player of the Year season. And that's a big deal. I mean, a lot of their offense operates on their bigs' ability to cover tons of grounds, you know, blow up pick and rolls, keep everything in front of them, their constant communication. And without Noah, that's one of the things that you saw that Rose mentioned specifically was the lack of communication. I think that's the kind of thing that he really excels at, and, you know, organizing, being the organizing principle on their back line there. They've also had, you know, trouble scoring in part because they're, you know, they're missing some important or some potentially important shooters and floor spacers for them. Mike Dunleavy Jr. has been out. Doug McDermott had a slow start to the season before he got injured, but that was somebody that they were hoping was going to be able to, you know, provide some shooting and some extra wrinkles in their offense to create more room, you know, for Gasol on the interior or for Derrick Rose driving lanes or, you know, in second unit play with guys like Aaron Brooks and things like that, or Taj Gibson, you know, on the interior. They haven't really been able to space things out quite as much, and they've had, you know, difficulties scoring the ball in stretches, which is, you know, nothing new in Chicago. But yeah, I mean, I think overall, you know, I'm talking maybe more about an endpoint that where there have been systems or symptoms earlier on. Like Joakim Noah doesn't get ground down like that if he doesn't play crazy amounts of minutes for the last half dozen years, because that's the way that things go, you know, and specifically late into the season and, you know, with playing on like torn plantar fascia and, you know, playing through all sorts of issues, which they, you know, is sort of the culture in Chicago that can really grind you down. I don't know that Rose necessarily was, you know, making a, you know, he's sort of subtweeting Tibbs there. I'm not sure that was what was happening, but I do think it's a legitimate concern if they're not able to get everybody back sort of healthy, especially Noah. If they can't get Noah back to, you know, sort of his full complement of skills and athleticism and, you know, minutes, then I think that that's a big issue for them. But, you know, you're absolutely right when you point that at the beginning. We were saying the same sorts of things when it was like, okay, is David Blatt going to get fired overnight?
Right.
You know, and then they win three games straight and you say, oh no, here come the Cavs. If the Bulls, you know, are able to get Noah back into the lineup, which should be happening in fairly short order, and they rip off a couple of wins in a row and all of a sudden they're holding teams to, you know, 90 points again, then I think we start looking at Chicago a little bit differently.
Right. I think we both expect these two teams to be there, close towards the end. It's just, it's funny, you know, the way the NBA is played and the way stars players are managed nowadays is that the regular season is not as important as the postseason, but the Bulls don't always adhere to those new rules. You know, their stars maximize their stars' input output during the regular season. So I wonder if that, as you said with Noah and other players, that is finally rearing its ugly head here with these nagging real serious injuries and I don't know. Coach Tibbs doesn't seem like the kind of guy to back away from that certain style, so I don't know if it's going to change at all for the rest of the season. With the Cavs, I am incredibly bothered by the predictable critique of the Cavs this season, which is that, oh, maybe we all kind of just, you know, we overinflated their chances, you know, that maybe they're not that good after all. I mean, we all need to pump the brakes here with the Cleveland Cavaliers and realize that any team that has LeBron James is still better than the majority of other teams that they're going to be facing. And so I was not one to worry. It is fascinating though to watch this team evolve. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was without LeBron the last couple weeks, you did start to see some flaws in the game of Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love. So I'm big picture for those two players. I wonder how much of an impact that's going to have on them.
I think it's potentially, you know, really important. You know, I mean, it's funny, there was that brief period at the beginning of LeBron's injury where Kyrie was also out. So the Cavs had to run everything through Love. And he looked remarkably similar to the guy that we got used to seeing in Minnesota. And then, you know, Kyrie came back and things sort of tilted a little bit. And, you know, then obviously LeBron comes back and, you know, looking, you know, remarkably refreshed and, you know, 30 points in three straight games. And, you know, the way things are supposed to be or that we're used to seeing things from LeBron. I wonder, there was sort of some static early in the season about, you know, LeBron maybe taking a back seat so that he could sort of let, you know, this idea of almost like negative leadership, like stepping back so that those guys could see that they needed to, you know, give him the reins and then sort of fall into place. And, you know, that he was maybe sort of slow playing things so that people could understand the natural pecking order that needed to develop. I don't know if that's necessarily the best way to lead young guys that haven't won anything yet, but I think if it comes in the natural flow of things, like, you know, with Love playing the way he was and the Cavs not having any success, and with Kyrie playing the way he was and the Cavs not having any success, maybe it comes to be a greater understanding of the way things maybe need to work when they've got everybody healthy. But that said, I think, you know, you're right to point out just that the overall talent level on this team is such that you have to consider them a dangerous team no matter what. But, I mean, think about all that's gone on in Cleveland. Like, that roster has almost completely turned over the last, you know, 12 months. They have, you know, a third of it has turned over over the last like 2 weeks. The third head coach in three seasons, a new, brand new offensive system that has to be tinkered and tailored, you know, seemingly every other day, depending on who's in the lineup and who's available. And, you know, you've got sort of a wide variety of things being juggled seemingly every time they hit the court. Of course, it's going to take a little bit more than, you know, time to get sort of used to things than you'd expect. I don't know if you know, now is the environment where we're going to see them go on a run. It could be. I mean, they still got some tough games in the schedule coming up ahead, but, you know, maybe having the you know, the opportunity to sort of reshuffle the deck, you know, rejuggle that rotation, you know, they're going to get, you know, now a handful of games with, you know, Mozgov at center and J.R. Smith the shooting guard. They should be getting on Shumpert hopefully back like a week to 10 days, get him into the rotation. They might actually get a chance to look at what their rotation is going to be moving forward. And I think having some stability in that context is really the biggest thing for them. You know, they know they've got the elite top level talent, but they have to figure out how, you know, the rest of the pieces fit in together, and they have to figure out how that pecking order develops. And with all the injuries and sort of juggling they've had to do, it's been difficult for them to do that.
Your colleague over at Yahoo Sports, Adrian Wojnarowski, wrote a fascinating kind of breakdown of LeBron and his body language this season and his lack of, I think the best way to put it is maybe not necessarily lack of leadership, but there does seem to be a sense of a lack of urgency with LeBron this year. And I thought the article that Woj wrote was really fascinating as far as LeBron's kind of relationship with Cleveland and the front office, and, you know, how his friends are kind of really throughout that front office, and how so many of the moves that are made are to keep LeBron happy. I found that really fascinating. The leadership thing is I think what we see on television is certainly different from what goes on in practice in the locker room. But the perception has been, you're right, is that he's kind of taken a back seat to hope that other people fill that void. And it just doesn't seem like there isn't another transcendent leader on that team other than LeBron James. So eventually he's going to have to be that player, that vocal leader that we were accustomed to in Miami. But we haven't seen it yet. But I have a feeling that it's lurking somewhere there. Speaking of kind of shifting our gears to another transcendent talent who missed some time this year, Kevin Durant and the Thunder are, I would say, in serious DEFCON level 3 or 4 jeopardy of missing the Western Conference playoffs. How likely do you think it is that the Oklahoma City Thunder miss the playoffs? And if they do, what do we think about the Thunder moving forward? Does that change the fortunes of Kevin Durant in Oklahoma City?
It certainly could. I mean, you know, I think there's a sort of an understanding that now the Thunder are, you know, there is no tomorrow for them. You know, like they've got, you know, about a year and a half before Kevin Durant enters unrestricted free agency, before, you know, they would lose control over somebody like Reggie Jackson. They're only a year further away removed from Russell Westbrook. You know, this is when they have to, if they're going to make this push, it's got to come now. I don't know. I feel like it's, you're right that they're in danger, certainly. I mean, you know, you open the season the way they did, with, you know, so many losses in the early going amid those injuries, and it's, you know, it's not going to work out super well. That said, they entered today's action about 3.5 games back of Phoenix for the number 8 seed. The Hollinger playoff odds through ESPN.com still give them a 41.7% chance of making the playoffs, getting into the 8 seed. Phoenix is in there at 55.2%. So it's still, you know, a little bit less than a coin flip, but, you know, there's the opportunity for them to be able to make a big push here, especially, you know, now, you know, Durant is now, you know, really ramping up. I believe the numbers are something like 55% from the floor, 45% from three, like some of the most efficient scoring he's ever done. Dion Waiters, for all of his flaws and the things about him that are crazy making, seems to have fit in pretty well there. You know, the shooting numbers are up. He's, you know, playing more minutes than he was in Cleveland. And, you know, those concerns that he wouldn't be able to handle not having the ball don't seem to have cropped up just yet. And, you know, Westbrook remains a holy terror. I mean, for better and for worse, but, I don't know. I think that there is an understanding that if you go through this period of time where you had Durant, Westbrook, Serge Ibaka, before that James Harden, you know, in their ascendancies and their prime, and you had them locked up, you know, with the exception of Harden, obviously, for, you know, the early parts of their primes, and what you come away with out of it was just one finals trip where you got, you know, beat up pretty good in 5 games by the Miami Heat, then that's a disappointing era. Maybe not a failure because they've been consistently competitive throughout, but that's, you know, it's a disappointment. And I think that there's an understanding of that they've got to kind of go for broke to push that over the course of the next, you know, this next second half of the season and then into next season. I really have a hard time imagining them still now missing the playoffs. But yeah, it's getting later, you know, a lot earlier now for Oklahoma City.
And I love I love watching Phoenix play basketball. You talk about, you know, a team that is fun to watch play basketball. We talked about the Atlanta Hawks. I think the Phoenix Suns are really, really fun to watch play basketball. They've got that crazy, you know, three-point guard, three-headed monster there, where they run, you know, Bledsoe, Thomas, and Dragic, and it's a fascinating team to watch. I don't know if they have the horses to keep, you know, the Thunder, hold the Thunder off, but it certainly is fascinating, and there is no wiggle room there in the Western Conference. You look up and down the top of the West, and you just do not see where you're going to have an easy night. I think you can say probably that there are, I don't know if you want to get into how many locks there are in the playoffs now, but there are certainly, I'd say, 6-7 teams that you can pretty much pencil into the postseason. Let's just say the Spurs, who've won 3 in a row, are going to be in there somewhere. So that does really realistically only leave one spot open, and it looks like the two most likely teams there are Phoenix and Oklahoma City. And can you imagine a postseason where the Oklahoma City Thunder come in as the 8th seed? You could potentially have, if I have this right, you could potentially have a first round matchup of the Golden State Warriors and the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yep, that would be right. And I think that's the, you know, if you got Steve Kerr under the influence of some truth serum or something else, I think that would probably be about the scariest thing you can imagine. Because you think about what kind of run Oklahoma City would have to be on heading into the playoffs to knock Phoenix off and get into that 8th seed. And yeah, I don't think that's the kind of team you want to see in round one, no matter how many regular season wins you've rolled up.
The Warriors are off to obviously such a great start, and I don't think as surprised as, say, the Atlanta Hawks are. But so much of the Warriors' success comes down to, you know, you've got the Splash Brothers, and you've got the maturation of guys like, you know, Draymond Green and things like that. But how much do you equate the success of the Golden State Warriors this year to the coaching and Steve Kerr? Because there's been a lot of talk about, you know, what kind of job did Mark Jackson do, and how much of this year's success is because of Steve Kerr? Do you buy into this leap being because of Steve Kerr?
It's tough to say. I mean, you know, there was somebody that I wish I remembered who it was. So, for, you know, forgive me, Twitter and basketball internet, but it sort of evoked, you know, the Jay-Z line, you know, you made it a hot line, I made it a hot song, where, you know, talking about, you know, what Mark Jackson did building up that team over the course of the last few years. And there's no question. I mean, you know, Stephen Curry, you know, evolved, you know, whether he was going to do that anyway or not, he, you know, became one of the, you know, handful of best players in the league, you know, most scintillating offensive players in the league under Jackson's watch. Klay Thompson became one of the best two-way shooting guards in the league under his watch. You know, that the rotation, you know, maybe had some concerns, and there weren't always, you know, maybe the best decisions being made in terms of who should be in the lineup or not under Jackson, but they advanced. A defensive culture that had never been there in Golden State, the entirety of basically franchise history, you know, developed under Jackson's watch. But then, you know, Kerr comes in and basically, I mean, it seems like he's batting 1,000 with every decision he's made. You know, for all the things that Stephen Curry did in terms of his advancement and evolution under Jackson, he was always sort of pushed to the side when it came time to defend point guards. There was like an expectation or sort of an assumption that he couldn't do it. And Klay Thompson was going to get all those tough assignments. Now Stephen Curry is defending point guards. Klay Thompson is defending wings, and it makes them a little bit more, a little bit harder to, you know, manage on the defensive end. You know, you've got, you know, heading into the season, David Lee was injured, which kind of gave Kerr an easier decision to be able to say, well, we'll put Draymond Green into the starting line of a power forward. And then that has played out beautifully. And, you know, when Lee's healthy, he said, you know, we're going to bring you off the bench because we've got something really good going here. And Lee has sort of gotten on board with that. And that's been a really smooth transition for them. There was the question of who should be the sixth man on the team, the first man on the off the bench. Is it Harrison Barnes, who really struggled in that role last year, or is it Andre Iguodala, who's been a starter throughout his career? And Iguodala, you know, accepted gracefully, or with as much grace as you can, the, you know, being demoted in that way, or the perceived demotion. And Harrison Barnes has been, you know, largely excellent as a small forward coming, you know, starting out games. You know, all of the, you know, the rotations now, he's playing Curry fewer minutes now because he knows he's going to need him to be playing bigger minutes later. He's juggled the rotations, you know, getting, you know, Justin Holiday some more minutes, a guy that we know no one really expected to be part of their mix, and now is playing sort of big minutes for them at times. There's, you know, moving back and forth between, you know, Leandro Barbosa is going to get a primary slot every now and again, or Sean Livingston is going to get some more run, kind of keeping everybody involved and, you know, as part of the plan. Kerr is doing, it seems like he's yet to make a wrong move there. And obviously, I mean, they're 33-6, so how many wrong moves could he have made? I don't know necessarily if Jackson had stayed around, if some of those sort of subtler moves would have, you know, evolved in the way that they have. But, you know, you look at, and also, you know, Kerr, you can't undersell. It's not just Jackson going out and Kerr coming in, but it's Kerr coming in and bringing in Alvin Gentry and the way that they've sort of restructured that offense, which, you know, it's no longer just sort of high pick and roll or, you know, hunting mismatch post-ups, you know, when Klay Thompson's got a smaller point guard on him. They run, you know, constant sort of motion. Draymond Green allows them to spread the floor a lot more. It really become very dangerous in a lot of different ways. And you know, Ron Adams, formerly of the Chicago Bulls, and, you know, is now in there as sort of the main defensive coordinator, which has helped that team become, you know, they made a big leap defensively last year, but now right up at the top of the league, even without Andrew Bogut, which was their big concern last year when they lost him, they really didn't have enough interior muscle to be able to, you know, to withstand some of the other Big West offenses. They've been great even without him this year. So, it's not just that Kerr is a better coach than Jackson. It seems like the overall coaching staff has taken a step forward and Kerr is, you know, continuing to hit all the right buttons.
Yeah. I love what you said about having an offensive defensive coordinator. I had no idea that NBA coaching was a lot like the NFL, but it seems increasingly like it is. You have offensive coordinators and you have defensive coordinators, and that's what they have in Golden State. And it's making a difference. All right. Last question, Dan, and then I'll let you get out of here. How much would I have to pay you to go and see the New York Knicks in person?
Man, I'd still go for.
Is it too easy? It's too easy. It's piling on. I understand.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Listen, I'm in a very zen place about the Knicks. I feel like for listeners that might not be aware, I'm living in Brooklyn. I'm a Knicks fan for my entire life, and I'm not out at games a ton at this point anyway, just because I wind up in front of League Pass most nights, and I'm sort of shackled to my house via a 4-month-old infant. But I would go see the Knicks for free. It's still going to Madison Square Garden. It's still covering games. It's just a bummer. And at least if you're going to have a bummer of a season to the extent that they have one this year, it's nice to have a first-round pick for the first time in, I don't know, 10,000 years, it feels like.
It does feel like an awful long time. It's tough. It's a tough time for basketball in the New York metro area. I don't know what your best bet is, the Knicks or the Nets. It's not really giving you that many options.
Your best bet is League Pass and staying up late to watch West Coast basketball.
Yeah, or maybe some Big East basketball, St. John's, and getting out and seeing some other teams. All right, Dan Devine, Ball Don't Lie, Yahoo's NBA blog. Thanks for coming on and talking some NBA hoops with us.
My pleasure, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Yep.